discussed yesterday in 3.8. So that was the first section of the chapter, which talked about how Karma Yoga is better for Arjuna than Gyan Yoga. So we will discuss the second section. Second section is telling Arjuna, if you can't practice Karma Yoga, then practice Karma Kanda. If you are not qualified for practicing Karma Yoga, then practice Karma Kanda. So here, if you see in the previous section, which we discussed yesterday, 3.1 to 3.8, Krishna has not said that Karma Yoga itself is higher than Gyan Yoga. What he has said is Karma Yoga is preferable for you to Gyan Yoga. So for you it is better. He has still kept the idea in Arjuna that Gyan Yoga is higher, but Karma Yoga is better for you. There will be a similar discussion in the fifth chapter where Karma Yoga and Gyan Yoga will once again be compared, and there Krishna will take the discussion deeper. So here now, Krishna will, as I told you, it's like a spiral. So first you talk about Karma Yoga is better than Gyan Yoga. So okay, you are talking about Gyan Yoga, but Karma Yoga is better. You think Karma Yoga is not possible, go to the downward side of the spiral. And say that, okay, what about Karma Kanda? You will practice Karma Kanda. So that's what we will start discussing now in this verse. So 3.9 is in one sense the verse which describes the culmination of the process of Karma Yoga, but it describes it in a non-specific way. Now Yajna, Prabhupada will quote in the purport, Yajna Vai Vishnu, Yajna refers to Vishnu, but that is not a necessarily a direct reference to Vishnu, it's an indirect reference to Vishnu. So, but what Krishna is telling over here is that the culmination of the process of Karma Yoga is to actually do everything for the purpose of, for the pleasure of some higher being. Yajnatha karmano anyatra, karmano anyatra, loko yam karma bandhanaha, tadartham karma kaunteya, tadartham karma kaunteya, mukta sangha samachara,
mukta sangha samachara.
So, one of Arjuna's concerns was that I will be bound by sinful reactions. And Krishna is telling Arjuna, yes, you will be bound in all situations except when you act for the purpose of your kingdom. So, indirect implication is that Arjuna, even if you are being inactive, even in the case of being inactive, you are actually active. So, because you are active in the sense that your mind is active, we talk about karma, indriyani, samyami, yasate manasasmara. So because your mind will be active, so even the mind's actions are within the purview of the law of karma, and there will be reactions for it. Therefore, the only way to be free from reactions is by acting for the purpose of your kingdom. That is the only way to be free. So the previous verse told Arjuna that yetam kuru karma, tam karma jnayo yam karma. Karma is preferred to the law of karma because that's how you'll be able to maintain your body. And if you remember, I discussed that yesterday. I discussed three reasons why Krishna has given why Arjuna should fight. So now here in this verse, Krishna is dropping the fourth reason, is avoid karmic bondage. So by acting alone, by acting for the purpose of Vishnu, you will avoid karmic bondage. Now, how karmic bondage will be avoided, that is not analytically described over here, but it is unequivocally asserted. Yes, this is how it is. This is how it is. A very unambiguous statement in terms of its impact. Lok agyatha karmano anyatra. Anyatra means otherwise. Loko ayam, in this world, karma bandhana. Everyone will be bound by karma. Therefore, tat artham. Therefore, for the purpose of yajna, do work. Now, what exactly is yajna? Yeah. As we discussed earlier, that words have different breadths of meaning. Sometimes the word can have a narrow meaning, it can have a standard meaning, it can have a very broad meaning. Do you remember any words we discussed with different breadths of meaning?
Buddhi
yoga itself. It's a stretchable word. Similar. Preaching, yeah, very good. We also discussed before that in the Vishwamitra, the word Veda. The Veda can literally mean the four Vedas, it can mean the Vedic body of knowledge, it can mean all knowledge in general. So words have different breadths of meaning. So the word yajna also has different breadths of meaning. So, generally speaking, the word yajna literally means to fire, means fire sacrifice. So, a sacrifice in which normal meaning in this case is narrow meaning, that's what people think about. That is, okay. Some yajna we have to do. That means there is a fire sacrifice, light a fire, put some ahuti in it, and then we have performed the sacrifice. Now, Srila Prabhupada explains in the Ishopita Purport that sacrifice means to deny the interest of the senses. That is the broader meaning. What is the broad meaning? To deny the interests of the senses. Now, how does the fire sacrifice deny the interests of the senses? See, some meaning is broad, then the narrow meaning should also be included in it. So, in the fire sacrifice, can you close the door? So, for example, in the ahuti, ghee is offered. Now, actually, people may think that ghee is so expensive. It's just putting it in fire and reduced to ashes. What a waste of money. At least, if you don't want to eat, give it to me, I will eat it. Isn't it like that? So, why waste ghee like that? So, ghee is considered to be a very rich food. And eating food cooked in ghee is considered to be a sign of opulence too. So, to deny the interest of senses means that what I could use for my enjoyment, I don't use it for my enjoyment. Similarly, the grains might be offered, or silk might be offered, various items might be offered. So, the purpose of this is at one level to deny the interest of senses. What is good for us, or what is pleasurable for us, we say no, I will not take. But is it just getting wasted? No, it's not getting wasted. The yajna is the mouth of Lord Vishnu. I quoted earlier that Devanam avamo agni, Devanam paramo vishmo, avano agni, tadanta sarvadevata. So actually, Agni is the means by which, Agni is the lowest among all the gods, and Vishnu is the highest. So lowest means that Agni is the medium through which we can connect with all the other gods. That's why Agni is most accessible to us, and that's why Agni is called as the lowest. It's not in terms of power. So Agni is the mouth through which what we offer goes to Lord Vishnu. So when we say deny the interest of senses, that doesn't mean waste the sense objects. It means what we could use for our sense gratification, we use it for Krishna's service. So Srila Prabhupada will generally use the word yajna in the broad sense. There are occasional places in the Bhagavatam also where the yajna is used in terms of narrow sense. Now if you see, the narrow sense will not make much sense in this context. Yajna arthat karmano anyatra. Now, Arjuna is doing his karma, he is a king, he is a fighter, he is an administrator, he is a family man. Now, all those are obviously not going to be fire sacrifices. All those are not going to be fire sacrifices. So, then this verse, if it is going to be taken literally, that apart from yajna, everything that a person does is going to cause bondage. That means 24 hours for 1,000 years or whatever time a person will be, person will just keep doing yajna throughout his life, isn't it? So, that obviously, that narrow literal meaning doesn't work over it. Krishna is talking about something broader here. So, that means all the activity that we do should be done in the mood of sacrifice. And these activities can give me pleasure, but I do them for Krishna's pleasure. I do them for the satisfaction of a higher being. Here, who is that is not mentioned clearly till now in the flow of the Bhagavad Gita, but the idea is do them as a sacrifice. Now, in fact, the word sacrifice, if you look at its roots, it comes from the Greek sacra, and that means to make sacred. Sacrifice is that which makes something sacred. So when you offer something to the Lord, and that makes it sacred. That is the original import of sacrifice. Now, after this, Krishna now starts talking about the system of yajna. See, Arjuna worked for yajna. So, in one sense, how is the flow going? The culmination of Karma Yoga was described here in 3.9. But after that, because the principle of yajna at the highest level satisfy the Lord. But when people cannot practice that directly, then there is a system of demigod worship through which they are performing yajnas, which are ultimately meant for Vishnu, but they are not directly meant for Vishnu. They are very devatato. So, Krishna now starts describing their system. Let this be the fulfiller of your desires. What? That Asha, that is the system of yajna. So this is actually, Krishna is taking from a specific to a very universal level the description in this verse. And the system of yajna which I am recommending to you, this is coexistent with the creation. As soon as the creation is there, along with the principle of yajna place. So praja sushtva, sushtva means creation. So as soon as people are created, along with them, saha yajna, yajna is also created. And vacha prajapati. So that being who created. Now the acharyas differ over here. Some acharyas say it refers to Vishnu, other acharyas say it refers to Brahman. That doesn't matter. Because ultimately it is the knowledge that is important. So Brahma is the secondary creator, Vishnu is the primary creator. So it depends on who is the focus. But the point is that creator, he instructed. What he instructed? That perform this yajna and through this your desires will be fulfilled. So in the universe, there is a whole system of cosmic cooperation. And this cosmic cooperation is essential for the purpose of the harmonious living of all people. Now, we understand that we are dependent on devatas. Do we understand that? Well, at least what we understand is that we are dependent on nature. We depend on nature, so maybe a few years ago, 8-10 years ago, in Nature magazine, they had an article called Humanity's Built to Nature. So what they said is that if we human beings had to pay our bill to nature, then it would be an astronomical amount. Yeah. So they said, researchers of the magazines, Science Nature magazine, in 1997, not clear there, it's straight out, they said that the researchers from the University of Maryland presented the world with a bill to nature for $16 trillion to $54 trillion US dollars per annum for the natural resources and raw material that humanity takes from nature. Food, water, air, lumber, rock, metals, well, oil and so forth. And if we have to pay a bill to the sun, then Dr. Edwin Kersley calculated that if we just took 5 cents per kilowatt hour for the energy provided by sun every day over the state of Oklahoma, one state in America, that cost would be $60 billion per day.
So, $60 billion per day.
These are far beyond, the amounts are so staggering. They are far beyond the budget of any country, the richest country in the world to pay. So what, of course, this article was not going beyond nature to God, but it was basically meant to raise eco-awareness. Yes, we are so dependent on nature. So, I had, when in Maharashtra government had tried to have artificial rains in India. So they had done cloud seeding experiments. At that time I had written this article. Artificial rains, imaginary gains, real pains.
So
the idea was that were they trying to do? They're saying that actually it's sometimes so tantalizing the way nature mocks human beings. Now there are clouds in the sky, but the clouds don't rain. There are some places and some situations when it's so dry that there are no clouds in the sky. So what can be done? So when they say artificial rains, nobody has yet developed a technology to make clouds. To actually evaporate water from the sun and make clouds, that will require so much more money and energy that just transporting water from elsewhere is 100 times cheaper than that. So they can't do that. But all that they say when they are doing artificial rains, there are clouds are naturally formed. And when the clouds are naturally formed, somehow they are in the sky, but they are not pouring down water only. So, in America, there have been many famous cloud property right disputes.
What does it mean, cloud property right dispute? That means, let's say there are two states.
And a cloud is there on the border, near the border of one state. And the way the wind is blowing, the cloud will go to the other state. But this state wants rain, so what they do is they do cloud seeding. Cloud seeding means that according to scientists, they have found that if certain chemicals are injected in the cloud, so basically the water is in a vaporous state in the clouds. So if certain chemicals are injected, then the cloud condenses and then rain comes. So by the natural process, the clouds will condense at a particular place. But they do cloud seeding. Cloud seeding means they send airplanes by the side of the clouds. That's what they try to do in India also, in Maharashtra. So they send airplanes, and then there is a scientist and a politician, and both of them are given some sort of small toy guns or something like that, with which they shoot these chemicals into the clouds. And then what happens? The hygroscopic chemicals, they are called. When they are shot into the clouds, then the clouds start condensing and rain start coming. So if that, say this is the border of two states and the cloud is over here and the wind is blowing this way, the cloud will cross over the boundary and go to the other state. So what happened? This state said that we want rain, so they sent plane and into the cloud ceiling. And the other state has a court case. They said this cloud was going to come to us. Why did you intervene?
So for decades they were trying there are various technologies called
weather artificial climate modification technologies. They've been trying for many years, and eventually they found this company that was there in America, they found that it's not economically viable. Because the problem is that even if we successfully see the cloud, we can't control which direction the wind will be. And we can't control the position from where the cloud will be seated. So if the rain just falls on a pavement or somewhere, then it just gets green. So even a normal cloud is there, a Caucasus cloud is there, Caucasus cloud. Actually, one cloud, if it is, it doesn't give so much rain. So who will control where the rain will fall? Only if it falls in a water body, then it will go around and it will settle. Rather just go into drainage, it will go into groundwater, which is not immediately useful. So after trying this for many years, they just abandoned the whole idea. And that company was going to go bankrupt. And that company came to Indian politicians and they said that, see, this is the technology that has been used in America. Develop India and start using this technology. So that technology was rejected in America. The Indian government took it as, we are progressing. We are using cutting edge technology. But actually it had not cut any edge, it had only cut the budget.
Isn't it?
So then they adopted it, and what happened was, we just got a few centimeters of worth of rain, a small area, nothing happened. Crores of rupees were spent on it. So this is the modern way of looking at everything just as a mechanism. As a mechanism. So from the atheistic point of view, people will say that, why do you bring Indra into the picture? Actually, the heat of the sun evaporates the water, then along with dust particles, the water vapors accumulate, it forms clouds, the clouds move, and condensation happens, and there is rain. Where do you bring God into the picture? Yes, there is no need for God if we just look at the mechanism. See, there is a question of how and there is a question of why. How things happen and why things happen, they are two different things. So, how can be explained by science? Why can't be explained by science? So, okay, why means what? Why at all there should be this complex system of cloud formation and rain showering? Science has no answer for it. Similarly, as I said, okay, as the rains are falling, why does the cloud condense at a particular place at a particular time and not another place another time? And now they can go into analysis and say, okay, this environment condition is like this over here, but it was like that over there. But why it was like that? We just go back to the root causes. Ultimately, science has to throw up its hand and say, a chance. It's chance. Now, chance is just a code word for ignorance. Chance is a code word for ignorance. See, there are certain situations where chance is an acceptable explanation. And there are certain situations where chance is an unacceptable explanation. When is chance an acceptable explanation? When we know that there is a pattern of probabilities and a particular event has a particular probability. Then chance is a reasonable explanation. So, for example, if somebody throws up a dice and it is said that if you get 6, you will win all the money. He throws a dice and falls 6. Now, why did it fall 6? It is by chance. We know that the probability of chance distribution is 1 out of 6. So, by chance, the percentage was 1 out of 6 and it 100 divided by 6, around 16.6 or whatever. And it came out to be that way. But suppose there is a bridge across a river and one day the bridge just collapses and the government made an inquiry, why did the bridge collapse? And the structure engineer said, by chance. Now this would be outrageous, scandalous explanation, because there is no process involving a pattern of probabilities. In this situation, chance is just a code word for ignorance. And explain this. So chance as an explanation. It's acceptable when there is a process with a probability well-defined process with a known probability of certain pattern of results, certain results. And among them one result occurs. If I throw a dice, I know it's a process. And there are 6 possible results in that process. One of them occurs, then chance is an acceptable explanation. But if acceptable when there is no well-defined process, there is no known probability, and there is no prediction of the result. That means that somebody says, okay, the universe just exploded in the hole, solar system and the earth and everything came. Okay, what is the probability that will happen? If you say that, okay, somebody will say 1 out of billion probability, okay. Is it possible that so many occurrences can take place? No. Who can repeat the Big Bang? Therefore, it's not an acceptable explanation. It's a little technical. I think the basic example of a dice, take the example of bridge collapse. That will make it clear. The technical words may make it a little unclear, in fact, rather than making it clear. So, science can explain how, it can't explain why. It can explain mechanism, it can't explain purpose. How rains occur, we can explain. But why rains occur, they can't explain that. Now, what is the Vedic understanding? There may be a particular process by which rains happen. But that process is supervised by a celestial being. And that being is Indra. So now, researchers have done some research and they have found that if in the Rig Veda there are certain yajna that are described, this yajna if you do, you get rains. So they have found that if the specific ingredients that were mentioned in the particular Rig Vedic scriptures are used, then they, when burned, give out a smoke which contains hygroscopic chemicals. That means that the same thing that modern science is doing, that same thing is done in the Rig Veda. What is done? There are clouds and we ignite fire. And through the fire, when the smoke goes up, that contains hygroscopic chemicals. And that causes rains. Now, what is the difference between the approach of Vedic seers and of modern science? The idea is we don't think that actually the smoke is causing the rains. We understand that this yajna is the way by which we satisfy Indra. And then he arranges for the rains. Now everything that happens in the material world will always have some material cause and effect to it. But the question is the material cause and effect complete? The material cause and effect is itself a valid explanation, but it is not a complete explanation. What is the difference between a valid and a complete explanation? It's like, I'm going into little technicalities, but this is important for us to understand. Valid versus complete explanation. So there is a, for example, if somebody starts how a car moves. So if I am a person observing from outside a house, the opening of a garage, and then the car comes up and the car starts moving. If I observe the car, how a car moves, so okay, the car moves because the wheels are moving. Okay, the wheels are, why are they moving? Oh, because they are connected to the axle. Okay, fine. And then there is a, why is the car moving? Why is the axle causing the wheels to move? Oh, because there was an ignition. There was a spark in the ignition and the engine started off. Okay, but why was there a spark in the engine? Well, this key was in the vertical position, the key moved to the horizontal position. Now if I go back to the explanatory chain, this is a correct analysis, it's a valid analysis. But if I say the car moved because the key moved from the vertical to the horizontal position, is it a complete explanation? It's a valid explanation, but it's not a complete explanation. Why the car moved is because the person who was the owner of the car decided to go for a drive. And when he entered, he moved the key from the vertical to the horizontal position. So, whenever anything happens in the material world, there will be a material chain of cause and effect that we can trace out. And that is a valid tracing. But that is not a complete tracing. So similarly, if I say that when I get angry, oh, I shake my fist. Okay? That is fine. Now I can trace out this. So, I can trace out the chain of cause and effect, backward, and I will find, okay, when I saw something externally, then that stimulated certain neurons in my brain. And when the neurons got stimulated, certain synapses were formed in the brain. And because of the synapses, I moved my hand. Now this whole chain, you can say, is correct. But it doesn't convey the emotion of anger. I felt angry, that's why I moved my head like that. So scientific explanation is valid, but it is not complete. So we agree, yes, there might be some hygroscopic chemicals which may cause some rains, but that is not a complete explanation. It is a valid explanation as far as it goes. So the understanding is that when we do yajnas, we satisfy the devata. So one way is to forcibly try to extract from nature our gifts. That it means the clouds have water and I go and forcibly inject some chemicals and try to take the water out of them. The other is that one satisfies and satisfies the Lord, who is the master of Mother Nature, by being religious, and then naturally Mother Nature will give out her gifts, whether they be rains or crops or whatever else. So the one way is like a child, when an infant wants milk, the infant just appeals to the mother and the mother gives her breastfeeding actually to the milk. The other is that the infant tries to catch the mother and force the mother to try to extract the breastfeeding from her. You don't need to do that. And that's not the right way to do it. So the point is that the system of yajna is a system of cosmic cooperation. And when we satisfy devatas, then they provide us our needs. That's how it works. So what modern science does recognize is that we are dependent on nature. But they think that actually nature is not conscious. Nature is just having certain mechanisms. And we need to harmonize ourselves with the mechanisms of nature. So there is both this environmentalism movement that is there now. It's a quite a popular and influential movement in the West. And I mean in India also. That we have to take care of nature. We have to live in harmony with nature, which is true. But they think that nature is dead. And their idea is that nature has certain mechanisms and we are disrupting those mechanisms. Yes, there will be mechanisms, but beyond that there are persons. And it is not just that we are disrupting the mechanisms, we are displeasing the persons. We are displeasing the Devata, we are displeasing the Supreme Lord, we are displeasing the Bhumi Devi. And that's why the supplies are being withdrawn. Any questions about this? So by this, Ishtakama Bhuk. By this, if you perform your yajna like this, whatever you need will be provided. So Prabhupada quotes this beautiful verse from the Bhagavatam. He says, you know, how the Lord is the pati of everyone. And he is basically, the relevance of this verse is quoting is, he is yajna pati. He is the Lord of the yajnas, the ultimate goal of the yajnas. And so then Prabhupada in this purport will again and again quote the point that actually speaking, in this age, the yajna that is to be performed is Sankirtan yajna. So now when Prabhupada is talking about Sankirtan yajna, what is he doing? Now the narrow meaning of the word yajna was fire sacrifice. The broad meaning is the principle of sacrificing the interest of our senses. Now again, the specific way in which you sacrifice our senses, sacrifice the interest of our senses in Kali Yuga will be by following the Yodharma. So what is the sacrifice that we are doing in Sankirtan Yajna? Sacrifice is not of fire, not of ghee or grains or cell. Sacrifice of our consciousness. We are trying to offer our consciousness to Krishna. So Sankirtan Yajna is not just our idiosyncratic idea that this is also yajna. Actually, the idea is that ultimately the purpose of our yajna is not just to sacrifice some goods. It's ultimately to offer our heart to Krishna. Sankirtan Yajna, what it does it? It is a means by which we offer our consciousness to Krishna. And our consciousness is a means by which we can offer our heart to Krishna. So the idea of the Vedic culture is that we should sacrifice. Ultimately, we have to offer our heart to Krishna. If I can't offer my heart to Krishna, then I offer that which is in my heart. What does that mean? Actually, I should love Krishna. But if I can't love Krishna, I love money. Okay, money is in my heart, then offer money to Krishna. So that is the idea. That way what will happen? We are creating a place within our heart for Krishna. So either I offer my heart or I offer that which is in my heart. And if I offer my heart, then Krishna takes a full place in my heart. But if I cannot offer my heart, then I offer that which is in my heart. And by whatever I am offering, I am creating a place for Krishna in my heart. So generally speaking, wherever our heart is, that is where we put our consciousness. Isn't it? For example, say, if there is a cricket match going on, one person is a cricket lover. He may be in his classroom, but his consciousness is, oh, what is the score now? What is happening? What is happening? What will be happening? So his consciousness is there, because where his heart is, there is consciousness is there. So similarly, if a person forces consciousness to a particular place, gradually the heart comes at that place. So in Sankirtan Yajna, we are offering our consciousness to Krishna, and that's how we are offering the heart to Krishna. So Prabhupada in this purport, he repeatedly says that it's the Sankirtan Yajna is the recommended way in which Yajna can be performed. Now, Yajna does produce the necessities of life, and as we will recite later, we'll talk about the rains which are produced by Yajna. So I'll talk about this Sankirtan Yajna producing rains at that time. Devan bhavyatanena
Devan bhavyatanena
Te deva bhavayantu yaha
Te deva bhavayantu yaha
Parasparam bhavayantaha
Parasparam bhavayantaha
Shreya paramavapsitha
Shreya paramavapsitha.
Any questions till now? So, Devan, so he is basically saying, you satisfy the Devatas and they will satisfy you. Now, some people have this idea that, some preachers within ISKCON, they have the idea that actually, if we don't do the Yajnas, Devatas will starve to death. Which is an absurd idea. Now, there will be some scriptural statements of like that. When Hiranyakashipu tells his associates to devastate the Yajnasthali, he is saying if the Yajnasthali is devastated, then the Devatas will become weak. And then he can attack and kill them. So he may say, and in his statements he may say that, oh, actually the Devatas will starve to death if we don't do Yajnas. He may say something like that. But we have to understand that just because the statement is in the scripture, that does not necessarily mean that it is an absolute reality. Hiranyakashipu is speaking to incite his followers to break the Vedic culture. The Devatas are not dependent on earth for their calories. It's not that they get food from there. See, if you look at other incidents in the scriptures, when Parvati sees that there is no place, there is no allocation of the share of sacrifice for Lord Shiva, she is not concerned, oh, my husband is starved to death now. Isn't it? That is not her concern. She feels he is disrespected. When in Govardhan Puja, the Vrajavasi stopped the yagya to Indra. Indra doesn't say, hey, I'll starve to death. What does Indra feel? Dishonored. So the yagyas are ways in which devatas are honored. It's not that they are dependent on food to live. When they come and accept the offerings, in the Ramayana described that, when a yajna is performed, if the yajna is performed properly, the devata will come and accept the offering. But on many occasions, they will accept the offerings invisibly. And only the Brahmins can detect that the devata will come and accept the offering. But in some cases, devatas may accept the offerings visibly. And when the devatas accept the offerings visibly, then it is considered that the yajna was exceptionally successful. In the Bhaktar Sandhu Sindhu, Srila Prabhupada is paraphrasing Rupa Goswami, and he says that people may ask that why don't the Devatas, then he's quoting that Shachi is telling Indra that basically the incident is that they're saying that, that the Apsaras in heaven, the wise of the demigods are saying that, you know, let this Krishna's pastime end quickly and let Buddha come. And when Buddha will come, then he will stop all yajnas. And when the yajnas will stop, then our husband will not go away to attend yajna ceremonies and they will stay with us.
It's an interesting thread of logic. But the idea is, so
Prabhupada quotes this for this point that actually, why are the demigods not coming for the yajna sacrifices now? He says, because after Buddha had the had the yajna stop. After that, the Brahmins also lost qualifications to do yajnas properly, and that is not the recommended way to perform yajnas in Kali Yuga, and therefore the demigods don't come because the people are unqualified, people can't do yajnas properly. So the idea is, so Prabhupada says, yajnas, the demigods don't care to come here. When they don't care to come here, means that it's not essential for them to come. So, but what is the system of cooperation? Then actually, when we satisfy the devatas, they satisfy us. And that is how Shreya Paramahamsa. So, it's more a system of offering mutual respects. We offer respect to the devatas. Otherwise, if I say that the Swargaloka is dependent on earth for food, it's like saying that America is dependent on Somalia for its food. Isn't it? It's absurd. It cannot be valid like that. But the idea is, when we offer our respects, what is happening is at least we are acknowledging there is a higher authority. And through that higher authority, we recognize ultimately the authority of the Supreme Lord. And Krishna is saying, by this, Shreya Paramavasitha, you will attain the ultimate Shreya, you will attain the ultimate long-term benefit by this. So Prabhupada quotes about how the arrangements for nature are made by arrangements for our necessities are made by nature. They are not made by human effort. Ishtan bhogan hibo deva.
Ishtan bhogan hibo deva.
Dasyante yagya bhavitaha.
Dasyante yagya bhavitaha.
Teyadattana pradayibhyo. Teyadattana pradayibhyo. Yo bhumte stena eva saha.
Yo bhumte stena eva saha.
So, when we satisfy the devatas, then they will provide our necessity. Otherwise, if we take what is given, then we will be thieves. So, we will be thieves. So, I wrote an article about after tsunami had occurred. There I showed how do we know that somebody is getting karmic reactions. Now, karmic reactions can come in three ways. Adhyatmik, adhibhautik, adhidaivik. So, I did a comparison of the adhyatmik, adhibhautik, adhidaivik klesha in the 20th century as compared to the 19th century. And if we look at the adhidaivik klesha, according to all statistics, the number of natural disasters that have happened in the last 50 years, the ferocity and frequency both are increasing more and more and more. The ferocity as well as the frequency is increasing much, much more. This is one way in which we can see that nature is offering us the karmic reactions. So now Krishna is telling over here, yo bhunte, you may be able to enjoy, but that enjoying is thievery. Sthena eva saha. Sometimes, so how does the system actually work? Sometimes devotees say that, okay, we do get on kirtan, and that's why rains have come. Now, this is valid, but it is quite simplistic. It is not invalid, but it is simplistic. So, if people say that, okay, there is a famine over there, go and do kirtan, let us see if the rains come. Then are they ready to go and do that? Srila Prabhupada does quote that in Hyderabad, we did the kirtans, and then Prabhupada said that there was this famous politician who said, some politician or somebody, he said that for so many years there was no rains, but when the devotees did kirtan, rains came. So Prabhupada does quote that, but Prabhupada did not make the mission of ISKCON to go all to all famined areas and start doing kirtans over there to get rains. See, we have to understand the whole system over here. What is the system? The system is that people have to follow the laws of God. Unless people follow the laws of God, just performing yajna is not enough. See, if we have a universal government, when will people get facilities from the universal government? So certainly we have to pay the taxes. The taxes are like yajnas. When we do the yajna, that is like paying the taxes. But along with paying the taxes, there are the basic laws of the government. They also have to be followed. So those are like the four regulatory principles. So if a citizen is to expect facilities from the state, certainly he has to pay taxes. But paying tax is even more foundational and fundamental than that. It is following the rules of the government. If people don't follow the rule of the government, then will the government provide the necessary, you know, they just pay some taxes. Paying taxes is one rule of the government. But apart from paying taxes, there are other rules of maintaining basic basic civil codes, basic morality, basic honesty, whatever. There are other rules that the government should be followed. They are not followed, the government will cut off the supplies. So it's not that just a one-off kirtan will produce rains. It may produce. But we are not trying to subvert the system which Krishna has created. The system that Krishna has created is that when humans live in harmony with God, then the necessities of life are provided by God through nature. So therefore, the idea is that kirtans may produce rains, but it is not just that one-off kirtans have to be done. The kirtans represent that people are living in God consciousness. So what we are trying to do is, we are trying to share God consciousness and make people God conscious. So people obey the laws of God and people also do kirtans. Then there will be rains. Yeah, otherwise, if we just naively start saying, we did a kirtan, so rains came. And then sometimes floods come. People will say, oh, you do too much kirtan, stop it now. Isn't it? So if we use simplistic arguments, you know, we can be embarrassed sometimes. So we shouldn't have such a naive conception. There is a sophisticated system of government over there. And although at one level, the act of chanting and dancing may seem very simple, but there is a profound philosophy behind it. And if we make simplistic statements, then we misrepresent the profound philosophy that is there behind it. Now, address your question. So Krishna is telling, Stenaivasaha. These people are thieves who take the goods from nature without returning to nature properly. So our modern society is a society of thieves. So now some people may say that, okay, if people are thieves, then why are people still prospering? We say that American society seems to be quite prosperous material. So there are several answers to it. First is that we should not just have a short-term vision of prosperity. Ravana was defying God and his Lanka was so prosperous that it was full of gold. So it is not that we should look at prosperity from a short term point. That's the first point. How long did that Ravana's reign last? It was destroyed eventually. So temporary phases of prosperity are possible by defiance of the laws of God also. We can't ultimately defy the laws of God, but there are temporary phases of prosperity possible. I'll explain this. There are several points in this answer. So how best prosperous without yajna? So first is temporary phases possible. Example, Ravana's Lanka. And more important is prosperity is not just material abundance, but it is holistic satisfaction. Are people satisfied in the West? You remember I showed earlier that slide about the American Paradox book, where people have the depression is higher, the suicides are higher, the divorces are higher, the crime rate is higher, the prison population is higher as compared to just 50 years ago also. So it is not just material abundance, it is holistic satisfaction, and that is not at all there. So beyond this also, if we look at it, we should not just think yajna and the fire sacrifices. There are still religious people there. There are religious people there and they are worshipping God in their own ways. So if the worship of God is performed, then that is fine. And there is also this concept of mass karma. Mass karma means that if people are overall sinful in one place, then they also get reactions. So the third point is some religious performances are still happening. And beyond that, so there is a concept of mass karma. Mass karma means that all of us have to get our own individual karmic reactions. But suppose a group of 50 people die in an air crash. And we understand that everyone of them had their own karma, but their karmic account was in such a way that all of them would die at this particular time. It's not all of them had the same bad karma. Similar quantity of bad karma they had done, by which they had to get the reaction of death in this particular time, in this particular way. Although their specific karmas might have been different. So, similarly, nations also have bad karmas. For example, when Prabhupada was in Japan, Japan is very earthquake prone. So Prabhupada said this earthquake prone nature is a symptomatic of karmic reactions. So that means, now who did the bad karma? Is it the people who are presently born or people who are past born? Well, both. It's both, isn't it? So similarly, actually, if you look at American history, till the time Sigmund Freud came to America in 1920s and 30s, America was quite religious. As I told earlier, the Protestants went from Europe to America, and they built America as a religious nation. As a "In God We Trust" was their slogan. So religion was quite a prominent part of America till not just 1920s. It went on further also. But gradually it went on the decline. And even now there are substantial number of people who are doing some religious rituals. So we don't have a narrow understanding of the Yajna specifically. The rituals that are talking about are very different. So it's a principle. The principle is that you should satisfy God. So those people who were religious in the past, and they, by their religious dharma artha kamacha, so by their religious actions, they produce some reactions which are good over here. And that will carry on to the next generation also. That means how it works is that, say, if a king is very virtuous, let's look at Vedic times and we'll come to our current situation. If a king is very virtuous, the king builds a very flourishing kingdom by doing proper dharma and everything. Then, when the king's successor is there, his son who becomes the next king, then he will inherit a flourishing kingdom. So now, is he inheriting a flourishing kingdom because of his own good karma or because of his father's good karma? It's both. His father's good karma arranged that the land be flourishing, and by his own karma, it was there he was born over there. So like that, by the past good karma of the people who live in America, this, the land is prosperous. And those souls who are born there, they had some good karma, that's why they are born there. The Prabhupada quotes in the purport of Janma Ishwara Shuddha Shrubhiya. He says that all of you Americans, you have wealth, many of you have beauty, you are intelligent. All this is a result of past good karma. Don't fritter it away. Don't waste it away. So now from one point of view, we can say that to be born in the Lichcha Desh is a bad karma, karmic reaction. But the important point is that even within Lichcha Desh, somebody can be born poor and somebody can be born wealthy. Somebody can be born intelligent, somebody can be born dumb. So that variety is also because of karmic reactions. So that is the mass karma result also is there. But the karmic reactions will catch up. The karmic reaction will catch up. And it's a big complex economic thing. I won't talk about it now. But America has the world's greatest debt. You know, America is the world's richest country, but America has the world's greatest debt. And it's a confusing system of economics that the country with the greatest debtor is considered to be the wealthiest country in the world. So that economic boom that is there is not going to last for very long. That's how temporary phases, sometimes without yajna prosperity, will also come. But that won't last for long. We'll continue with that. Thank you very much. Srila Bhagavad Gita ki Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaura Bhaktivedanta ki jai, Gaura Bhaktivedanta ki jai. Thank you.